MechCast, Friday, June 24th, 2011. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Yeah, you know, it's a little later in the week than I was hoping to get this show out to you, and the show is actually going to end up being a little bit different than the original show that I had planned. There's a lot of news, a lot of stuff going on, most of it rumors and stuff like that. I have some good feedback and things to get to, and I was hoping to get all that done this week, but I ran into some issues with my Mac. My MacBook Pro, that is my main machine I use for everything. I shouldn't say I ran into it, because it's had this issue for a really long time, and I've been putting it off because I've been able to kind of work around it. I have a small video issue and an issue with the USB and FireWire bus. So actually, really, two things were going on. Every once in a while, I was getting these weird, strange screen glitches where, you know, just almost like a static would go across the screen maybe once, two, three times a day. Really annoying, but not really affecting the functionality of the machine. The bigger issue that I was having is I use a FireWire audio interface. It's called an Alesis IO14, for those of you who want to know, to run my microphone into the Mac and actually record in GarageBand. And I was having these issues where that interface would just die, like the FireWire bus would just die. And then I started having issues where if I plugged in a FireWire device or a USB device, sometimes it would kill the whole entire FireWire USB bus. And I'd get that horrible message about, you know, disconnecting my hard drives and not ejecting them before I did that. Now, unsafe disconnecting of the drives. And I wasn't disconnecting anything. Very oftentimes, I was actually plugging in a USB accessory or something like that, and it would just kill the whole thing. So I knew I had this problem. It was intermittent. I was putting it off and putting it off, and I finally decided. I got back from Nerdtacular. If you don't know what that is, Scott Johnson, who does or used to do Extra Life Radio, does the Extra Life webcomic, has a whole network that he started up called Frog Pants Studios. He does Film Sack, which is a great film review podcast. I mean, I could go on and on, but check out his stuff over at Frogpants. I think you've heard Scott. He's been on the MacCast before. He puts on an event in Utah, so I'd gone out to that. A lot of fun. I got some great interviews. I'm putting those out as member episodes, and then should have them on the MacCast in the future. But if you want to get early access to them, you can go sign up for the MacCast members program at member.maccast.com. But came back from that, and I thought, you know, I got to deal with this. My AppleCare is going to be running out soon. And so I decided, well, you know, take it in and then go from my super duper backups and start working on my Mac Mini, my trusty old Mac Mini, which I've had and have been using as a media center. Anyway, long story short, all that whole process in my mind, I thought it was going to be simple and happen quickly. And of course, that wasn't the case. I was dealing with stuff and other work and catching up on things, and I've fallen behind. So I don't want to make excuses for myself, but I had an opportunity actually to sit down and interview another developer. So a lot of you really enjoyed my conversation with Michael Simmons from FlexiBits and Fantastic Hal. And I was contacted by actually an old friend and fellow podcaster, Matthew Bischoff. He's now doing some coding and working with some programmers and building apps for iOS. And so I had an opportunity to sit down with him today. I'm a little behind on getting the next episode of the MacCast out, so I didn't want to leave you high and dry. I wanted to give you something, and we had a great conversation today. So that's what I am going to deliver you today. Hopefully, in the next couple days, I will put out a MacCast. Oh, and I guess I should summarize. I'm a little scatterbrained today, can you tell? I should summarize what happened with my Mac. So this MacBook Pro I've had for almost 3 years now, so it's getting towards the end of its AppleCare. And this is why I love AppleCare, because it's had some problems. I had a video issue where they swapped the logic board. I had some other I think a second kind of video issue where once again they swapped the motherboard. And so this was the third time it went in. They looked at it and said, yep, you need a new motherboard. And I said, fine, go ahead and do that. Well, not long after I hung up with the genius at my local Apple store, he called me back and he said, you know what? I reviewed your case. I've seen you've had a lot of issues with this machine. How would you feel if we just replaced it with a new one? And I said, no, go ahead and repair that old one. No, of course I didn't, right? I did like any of us would have done. And I kind of, you know, bit my lip and tried not to scream jubilation into the phone. And I said, oh, yeah, I'd really like that. Thank you very much. And they transferred my data and I went and picked it up. So needless to say, my three-year-old MacBook Pro was swapped out for a new Core i7 model. So happy ending, but I'm in the process of kind of putting everything back together and getting the studio back together. So that's what's going on with me. And for you, I've got this great interview to play for you. And I think it's very appropriate because there's a lot going on, not just in the Apple Mac community, but we have this whole thing, this whole strange reversal, especially on the iOS, mobile, tablet, smartphone side of the tech community, where Apple is now in a leadership position. Having been an Apple and Mac fan for so long, it's always been, we're the little guy, right? We have the small market share. And even on the Mac side, on the notebook side and desktop side, Apple is making huge strides. They're gaining big market share. They're earning lots of profits. And a lot of the PC industry is sort of standing around scratching their heads, wondering what happened. And particularly on the mobile side, I really believe and feel that everybody's trying to copy Apple's hardware. And what they're really doing is they're missing the point. And it's funny to me because this is a formula that Microsoft used for years. Microsoft didn't do hardware. They sold software and they built their whole empire on the power of the software. And Apple now with the hardware and what they're doing with the software and really reaching out to developers, this was a complaint about Apple for a very long time. But what has changed is they really have built platforms that developers are excited about and they're really nurturing that developer community. And it's really the software and even more than the software, just the experience of using these devices and how, to quote Steve Jobs, magical that is when all that stuff comes together. And so it's great for me to be able to sit down and talk to the folks who are now in this community building these great apps and very excited about these platforms. So we did Michael Simmons a couple days ago. I think I'm going to try and do more of these. A lot of you wrote in to tell me that you really enjoyed that interview. And so to have this opportunity to sit down with Matt and just talk about what's going on with Apple, what's changed, their excitement over the platform, and talk about how do you take an idea and a concept and nurture it and build it and create something in this community and on these platforms. And it's a lot of fun to sit down and do that. So I'm going to get into that conversation in a minute. Before we do that, though, I do need to take a moment and handle some business. I want to thank some sponsors. The first one is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, great applications. I want to talk to you today about Text Expander. This is one of those apps that I rely on every day. I've been using it for years before they were actually a sponsor of the MacCast, and I absolutely love it. It's critical for me in doing things like answering emails. I have Text Expander snippets that I use for inserting different signatures, and I probably should explain how the software works. So what it enables you to do is define abbreviations, little shortcuts of text, sequences of characters. So for example, I use SIG1, SIG2, SIG3. So SIG the number one, SIG the number two, SIG the number three for different signatures. And anytime I type those characters together anywhere in the operating system, so in an email, in a text document, what have you, Text Expander is sitting there, it's running in the background, it has a little menu bar icon, and it recognizes that as one of my shortcuts that I've set up, and then automatically expands and inserts the appropriate signature. So full signature, my full name, contact information, all that stuff automatically gets inserted in place. You can even include things like graphics, and it just is really powerful. I also have snippets for answering very common email questions, so I don't have to keep typing the same thing over and over again, because there are certain things that come up, questions that come up repeatedly. So if I notice that I have a common one, I'll add that as a text expander shortcut and snippet. A great feature that it has built in is it comes with some predefined snippets for some very common actions. So once you have text expander installed, go under the file menu, you'll see an add predefined group option. And then within there, they have some pretty useful snippets to get you up and running when you first have the application. So one they have is commonly misspelled words. So if you're a bad speller like I am, you can turn that on, and little misspellings that you might do accidentally will automatically get corrected by Text Expander. Accented words is another great one. So if you want to have the proper accents on some common words, say doppelganger, that one's in there. You type doppelganger without the accents, and suddenly it inserts the accents and the little umlauts, is that what they're called, in the appropriate places. And they have a bunch of those built in, so you don't have to remember those little keyboard shortcuts. They have HTML snippets. I'm a web programmer, so they have great ones for doing HTML, and it'll automatically expand and even can insert the insertion point at the proper place for adding attributes or putting the text within the tags. It sits there and puts it right in the right spot, so you're ready to go. So saves a ton of time, just a really great utility. And they have Dropbox and Mobile Me syncing, so if you have multiple Macs, you can sync between that. And for mobile, they have Text Expander Touch, which is on iOS. And you might be thinking, well, Text Expander sounds like it needs to be running in the background. Well, Smile thought about that, and they built an API, and now Text Expander is integrated in over 114 different apps. So there's very good odds that one of the apps that you use on your device already has built-in support for Text Expander, and you can take your snippets from your desktop and transfer them, sync them over to your iOS device, so you have them on the go, you have them on your desktop, you can use the same ones. It's fabulous. It's really great software. They make great stuff. You can get more information and details on it over at smilesoftware.com. Check it out. They have free trials available, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I'd also like to thank Stitcher, makers of Stitcher Smart Radio app, the Stitcher Smart Radio app for iOS and Android. You can listen to the MacCast on the go. New episodes, when a new episode comes out, you don't have to have synced it. You don't have to go back to iTunes and sync it back up. If you have Stitcher Smart Radio on your device, just fire up the application. You can even favorite the MacCast. You can favorite all your other favorite podcasts. We Have Communicators is another one I do every week with Michael Johnson and Jeff Gamet. Great podcast on iOS stuff. That's in there. They have a built-in directory. Also has support for local radio. It's a streaming application, so you stream. You don't have to deal with the hassles of syncing. And it's a free app. You can download it right now. And right now, they're also offering the opportunity for a chance to win an iPad 2 to new listeners. So when you download the app and you register it, you sign up, enter the code MACCAST, and you will be entered to win that iPad 2. You can also go to stitcher.com/MACCAST now, and it will give you information on the promotion, how to enter, and you can even have an email reminder sent to you to go download the app. But the easier thing to do, just go to the iOS store now, go to the Android store, download the app, and when you're installing it, enter the code MACCAST, and you'll be entered to win that iPad 2. So that's Stitcher.com, STITCHER.com/MACCAST, and a big thank you to them for their support. Okay, let's get into the interview with Matthew. Matthew's with Lickability. Probably should have mentioned that earlier. Lickability.net is the website, and they have an app called Quotebook. But really, we sat down and we just talked about how he became a developer involved with development, the whole process of taking an idea, concept, and moving that through production and getting something in the App Store, and also just a little bit about the Mac and history and WWDC. You'll hear all the stuff that we get into. It was a lot of fun, and I'm glad he came on the show. So here you go. Hey, Matthew, thanks for agreeing to come talk with us on the MacCast. How are you doing?
Oh, great, Adam. Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
It has been a while. I think, yes, since we spoke. Well, for people who don't know, I want to start with a little bit of your history. Matthew Bischoff, I know you from podcasting.
Yes.
Back in the day, it's funny to say it that way now, but back in the day, because it's been 6 years since we kind of started this thing. You were the, probably, were you the first or the one of the original kind of, they called them, I hate these names, but teen podcasters, right?
Yes, I believe I was the first. All evidence is pointing to that, but I mean, it's very hard to verify because a lot of that information isn't around anymore. It's been sort of pulled off the web or whatever. But on podcast.net, which was a website back then that was tracking all the podcasts, I was ID 11. So I was the 11th podcast in the system.
Right.
And I'm listed as a podcasting pioneer on iPodder.org, or at least I was.
Oh, there you go. Is that site still around?
I have no idea.
Well, so when let me ask you this. Here's a good way to gauge it. When did you start? Do you remember when you started podcasting? Because I started December 2004 was my first episode. So I think December 13th, if I'm remembering, or 14th, if I'm remembering.
I had an episode in September of 2004.
Yeah, so even before me.
Yeah, that was my first episode.
Which was very early. And I think, you know, the earliest, I mean, Adam was kind of doing it around October, maybe a little bit earlier. So this is like, you know, the birth of podcasting as we kind of know it today. So you were in early. We're all in that kind of original group. So that's how I got to know you. And then you've since gone on to do other things. Are you still podcasting, by the way?
I wish. I am in development of a couple of ideas, and I want to get back into it. So hopefully look forward to that, but I haven't started any of those yet.
Yeah. Well, you kind of had school and things, right?
Exactly. High school turned out to be a lot of work. And
and then college now, are you?
Yes. Yeah. I'm in college.
And then you've started doing some development. So I think, you know, ideas is probably a good theme for this, you know, how we, a lot of people have ideas. And what I've been getting a lot, and I just did an interview, I think you heard it, with Michael Simmons, who just launched Fantastical and FlexiBits, which is a new company. He was originally in some other areas in the Mac community and moved on. And more, I just joined an iOS development group. I'm not doing anything actively, but obviously very interested in it. And I get a lot of people who listen to the show who ask me, you know, I've got an idea, or I'm wanting to get into coding, or I'm a marketer. I mean, there's lots of aspects of developing for the Mac and iOS, or just in general, creating something, be it a podcast, yeah, be it programming, what have you. And so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that. Before we get into that, though, you know, the big thing that I'm getting a lot of questions about now is WWDC and all the announcements and what Steve Jobs talked about in his keynote and some of the things that are happening with Lion and iOS. And I know you weren't at WWDC, but sounds like you had a chance to run through the keynote like all of us Mac geeks do and might be going through. Apple just posted the developer sessions. So just what was your general impression of what was announced at the keynote in, you know, any area? Pick kind of some of your maybe highlights of what you think Apple's up to.
Sure. Well, I was following the keynote live, like I'm sure all the really geeky Mac nerds out there. And
I think even non-Mac nerds is the funny thing.
I really wish they had video streamed it. I love watching the live video streams. I wish they would go back to that.
Yeah, me too.
But I think that it is really overwhelming. The amount of stuff they announced, even without announcing any new hardware, just the sheer amount of software changes that they announced is completely overwhelming. And trying to sift through it as a developer or even just a user is sort of like, oh my God, how did they do all of this in a year?
Right. Yeah. I watched the intro to one of the keynote, one of the new developer sessions. And I think they said something like 3,000 new APIs in Mac OS X and 1,000.
Apple loves to do these huge numbers, like on the Mac OS X Lion page, you know, 200 new features. They love these huge numbers of new APIs and new features, but my biggest takeaway from the keynote was definitely iCloud.
Okay.
I think that iCloud really provides something that developers of Mac applications, iOS applications have been crying out for since iOS 2.0, and that some of the best applications have had to go and do themselves, which is syncing. And anyone who's written syncing knows it's really, really hard to write good syncing.
That's always been a challenge.
Yeah.
You know, talk to anybody who's had to deal with that. You're absolutely right. Even Apple with, you know, in the early days with iSync or was it Markspace who makes all the great syncing software? It really is a big challenge. I'm curious because you mentioned that, you know, it is exciting that Apple is baking this stuff in, but then very often you have this conversation that comes up. Well, what about all the developers who are already doing a lot of this kind of work, who have taken the time to write great syncing things with respect to iCloud and the document stuff? You know, there's a lot of conversation about Dropbox, right? Dropbox went out and built a system. A lot of developers use it and have baked it into their software. What happens to them? You look at a technology like Reading List, which is being built in to Safari, which kind of mimics or has some of the functionality of something like Instapaper. I mean, is Apple taking away from those developers by baking this stuff in? Is it? Do you see it as a problem, or do you see it as just something that's additive? I'll weigh in with my opinion, but I'm curious to get yours.
Sure. My thought process is very much aligned with the... I believe it might be a misquoted Picasso quote, a good artist copy, great artist steal.
Yeah, that's also quoted to Steve Jobs very often. Right?
Yeah, which is extremely odd. he says some great stuff. I mean, real artist ship is a great quote that Michael brought up on that previous interview.
Right.
But I think that part of what makes Apple so great is that they look around the ecosystem and they do their own sort of minimalistic, good enough for 90% of the users spin on these things. And that increases competition, and that makes the platform better.
It's, you know what, that 90% thing that you mentioned there, I think is it. And the statement of they do kind of just enough. They kind of take the core concept of it. And I think that's why some of the rumors about, oh, this is going to kill Dropbox, or this is going to be a big impact on Instapaper, what have you, get a little bit overblown. Because I think of features like RSS is a big one for me. You know, Apple integrated RSS into Mail, and they integrated RSS into Safari, and everybody went, oh, well, NetNewsWire and Reader and all these things aren't going to be needed. And that's so far from the, you know, from actual reality for a lot of users like myself. I think it covers the basics. So if you don't know what RSS is, and I think Marco even wrote a kind of a blog post about this after he had time to digest, you know, there was this immediate reaction like, oh, you know, OMG. but then you step back from it and you go, okay, well, let's see what Apple is really doing here. It's not been clear if they're actually making an API for this stuff that, you know, developers can tap into. So if there's no API and third parties can't kind of add into Reading List or read from it, then, you know, it's kind of locked into Safari. And if you're not a big Safari user, then you might need something else. You know, there's those things like that. Or it is really basic functionality. So if you need to go beyond those features, you're going to go out and look for something a little more robust. And I think if you see as a developer, you see the opportunities in that. And the other big advantage I think he mentioned is, well, all those people who didn't realize they needed something like Instapaper suddenly have a built-in thing that's going to give them a little taste and kind of get them addicted. You know, it's almost like the free sample, right? When you're
at the
food court at the mall, here, try this, and then you're like, oh, I want to have that. I want to have more of that. And Apple doesn't really offer them more in a lot of cases.
It's true. He compares that to sort of Starbucks moving into a small town and actually increasing the demand for indie coffee shops,
right?
Which is a phenomenon that tends to happen. And I think that there are actually two sort of distinct classes of applications that Apple copies. There are some things that Apple copies that are extremely obvious. An example here would be the application, I believe it was called Light Switch X. Before Command Tab existed, showing the application switcher, there was an application that had that same functionality, and Apple mimicked it almost exactly.
Right.
Now, that application didn't go away, but I think that it decreased the need a lot and probably hurt their business a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the other side, which is the applications that are sort of complex that Apple simplifies down, which is stuff like NetNewsWire into the RSS and Safari and Mail. And I think those applications are fine. So if you're building something that's really simple that Apple can just copy, you know, and has the desire to copy, you're probably going to have some issues. But if you're building OmniFocus, right, which is this multi-layered complex task management application, you're not going to be killed by the Reminders app in iOS 5.
Right.
That's my take on it.
Yeah, and Apple does some interesting things too, where they'll take something. Notifications that we saw is a great example. On the surface, when I was looking at it, I'm like, well, that they just copied what Android was doing. But then you start to dig deeper and you go, okay, wait, they kind of took that core idea, which, like you said, is in a lot of ways obvious, and then improved, you know, found ways to kind of improve upon it. And I think that's a good lesson in general for developers, because getting into this conversation about development, one of those things that I'm often asked is, I have this idea, but it's like this thing, and I don't want to just copy it. And that's absolutely true. You don't want to just copy something. I mean, in some cases, like you mentioned, if it's completely simple, Apple might do that outright. I think the dilemma, or the thing that upsets some people, is that very often they do it and they don't kind of go back to that original developer. They just kind of take the idea, and then, it like you said, their business might get stomped on. But then other times they do strange things. Like, you look at something like Coverflow, and they bought that one.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, but then go talk to Corellia about Watson, and Apple just kind of, it's pretty obvious. And Apple says it was, you know, the next evolutionary step, and they may or may not be right, but it seemed at the time like, oh, they're just stealing this. And then you go back, and Jobs has that quote, great artists steal. And you can kind of point out lots of times where it seems like they have just really, really stolen. And even moving into some of the stuff where we're looking at, with a lot of the lawsuits that are going on now surrounding iOS, and Apple just kind of will take things and hope that, you know, nothing happens, and then they go to court and end up paying some licensing fees, and it just kind of all gets swept under the rug. So there's a lot of, I think, Apple doing, and I think a lot of companies do this, not just Apple, but a lot of, you know, do it, ask permission later, and if you get caught, then make restitution.
Absolutely. I do, however, wish that Apple would sort of be a bit more respectful of the ideas that they're taking and look into partnering with the developers or purchasing these companies. Apple has,
me too,
you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of cash, or no, billions of dollars of cash, right? They've got
something like 80 billion at the last
80 billion,
count,
right.
Yeah.
Or it's coming up on 80 billion. And
close, yeah.
they can use that money to buy these relatively small shops, and I think people would have a lot more respect, and they wouldn't have all these articles talking about, you know, Apple stealing things. It would be more like Apple buys Coverflow and then rolls it into the products, and it's awesome.
Yeah, I think we have this weird dilemma because we're fans of Apple, and we want to think of them that they're better than other companies. And that they do business in a different way.
Sure.
I've had the same dilemma when it comes to some of the working conditions that we hear about out of China and stuff like that, right?
Right.
And I think Apple is doing a better job than some of their competitors, but you certainly can't say that they are doing, at least in my mind, absolutely what they should be in terms of being responsible. And I think the same thing comes to light when you start talking about just business moves. You know, at the end of the day, we have to kind of step back and remember Apple is a company, you know, in a global market, and they're going to behave like the large company that they are sometimes, even though we as users and fans really wish they wouldn't. You know, I don't know.
At the same time, I think that Apple is, you know, a lot of times people talk about, like, oh, well, Apple does this, Apple does that, as an extension of sort of Steve Jobs.
Right.
And that's also not the case. Apple's made up of a lot of different people. And I think that maybe even just if some of those people were to make it a priority to credit these ideas or to purchase these ideas from developers or license them, I think there could be change.
That would be wonderful. I'm not a business major, and I don't know all the ins and outs either. I mean, there's weird quandaries you get into too, right?
Of course.
And so if you try and give credit, you could end up in a situation. You know, lawyers get involved at some point, and then it just all goes downhill, I think.
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
So there may be, you know, there may be executives that really do want to do that, but, you know, they take it to the corporate lawyers and they go, well, you can't do that because then this guy is going to come out of the woodwork and that guy's going to come out of the woodwork and, you know, suddenly our war chest is gone because we're, you know, tied up in all, I mean, not that they're not already tied up in lawsuits, but sometimes they don't need more. I don't know. I think it's hard to know from an outsider's perspective all of the intricacies of what's going on behind the scenes, and we try and speculate about that stuff, but we'll never really know.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
But some very, very cool technology. So you mentioned iCloud. You know, I think that is a huge initiative. Do you think Apple has the chops, given past history with cloud initiatives? I mean, do you think this is their thing that's going to break out, or are we going to end up with more of the same kind of issues?
That's a good question. I think that they certainly think that they have the experience to do it at this point. I think that Steve Jobs sort of making fun of MobileMe on stage was a way to do that.
Right.
Was a way to say, hey, look, we realize that we screwed up and we've completely rethought the way they're doing this. And they have really re-architected things. I mean, I am under the NDA as a developer, but the way that they're doing sync now is a lot different philosophically than they were doing it before.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it is much more like a Dropbox idea of sync. The cloud is much more the owner of the data than each of the devices are. And I think that that's the right way to do it.
What do you think about this concept of Apple seems to be more focused on the push side of things, mm-hmm. and the sync side of things than sort of the old, what I don't know if you'd call this the old server model, but it's the model that everybody's comfortable with, right? That I throw something in the cloud and it's ready and waiting when I want to access it. Apple seems to be taking this opposite approach that's, no, we're gonna enable you to kind of just push everything out to your devices. And I guess my hesitation there, I like the idea of that because it enables some offline stuff. I can see some advantages to that, but I also see some potential huge challenges and disadvantages that worry me, specifically bandwidth and storage, especially on, you know, devices like iPads and iPhones, where personally I already am kind of having to manage my data too much on those devices, if you ask me.
Yeah. Well, storage is definitely a concern. I think that Apple has attempted and hopefully solved the bandwidth issue because they are only pushing deltas. So they're not pushing every file every time it's changed. They're just pushing the differences.
Right.
So hopefully bandwidth won't be that large of an issue. And in the developer, talks and documents, they're really making a big deal about the fact that these people are on mobile devices. They're on the subway. They don't have a crazy amount of bandwidth. So you have to be really careful with that.
Right. So related to this, what do you think about the concept of equalizing the platforms and pushing the hub, as it were? I think Steve Jobs said, we're moving the hub to the cloud, kind of getting everything out of iTunes and making Macs, iPods, iPhones, iOS devices, Apple TVs, whatever is going to be coming out in the future, sort of tap into this network internet-based hub.
Yeah, well, I think anytime you can get anything out of iTunes, that's a good move. iTunes,
yeah,
right now on my system, if it was running, it would be taking up 200 megabytes of memory. And I don't even know what
beast.
It's doing.
Yeah.
I have no idea. It's just this huge application that started out. I went back and watched the keynote where iTunes was introduced, and it was this cute, tiny little media player. But now it's just in charge of everything with
that
all
was
these
another
devices
one where,
that we have.
Yeah, that was another one where they bought... Didn't they buy... what was that?
They did.
App. Now I'm blanking on it. Sound...
I don't remember.
Sound Jam.
Yeah.
From Cassidy Green was the original iTunes.
Before that, they were in talks with the Panic guys, right, to buy Audion?
I don't remember the specific history, but I know they ended up with Sound Jam, and that's what was tweaked to become
right.
to kind of the first iTunes. And that was a case where they did actually buy out the technology.
Yeah.
So it's just weird when it's hard to tell when Apple actually is going to go buy something or just kind of try and copy it. It's, you have no, really no clue. As a
developer. I think the larger that you are, you probably have a better chance.
yeah,
for instance, they bought Siri, right? They bought Siri last year.
Yeah, and a bunch of mapping companies. And
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Well, beyond iCloud, anything else that jumped out at you at the keynote as you just went, I'm really excited about?
Well, iOS 5, if you look at all the slides, and especially those slides with all the little tiny words on them that show all the new features of iOS 5, it's hopefully going to shape up to be an incredible release. I have it installed on my iPad 2, and it is a bit problematic. And I did have it installed on my personal iPhone 4, which was a terrible idea that my partners at Lickability, Brian Capps and Andrew Harrison, were ribbing me for weeks.
Yeah, I know we can't do too many details. I did the same thing. I have it on my iPad too. I'm in the developer program as well.
Right.
Obviously we can't, on NDA, we can't really talk about details. But
yeah, we can talk about anything that Apple has talked about. it's Notification Center. I miss it now that I'm back on iOS 4 on my iPhone. I miss it so much. I keep trying to swipe the status bar and nothing happens. And
yeah.
I start to tear up. And besides that, I think that a lot of the stuff we haven't even seen yet. For instance, I mean, everyone who's installed the developer preview hasn't even seen really what Newsstand can do yet. That's interesting.
Right.
And the new stuff in Game Center. I think that iOS 5 is really sort of a big feature release with a lot of new things, a lot of new applications that they've added, but also just so many of those things that we love about Apple, those little tiny tweaks, things like the camera on the camera shortcut on the lock screen, right, that they announced in the keynote. That's just how I've wanted that for so long, and I didn't even know that I wanted it.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like, looking at the feature list, it seems like Apple's finally brought iOS into equilibrium with a lot of what their competitors are doing on the software side. I think they've almost squashed just about every complaint that I can think about. I think weigh in on this from your side, but Apple is very deliberate about, I think, how they bring out new features. So they, you know, a good example, notifications. They've gotten a lot of flack for not having notifications. Why doesn't it have a better notification system? And I think it's because they wanted to make sure that they got it right when they did it. I think Apple has this concept of, it doesn't like to redo things. It likes to get it right the first time. It doesn't like to play the third version is the good version game that a lot of people play.
Microsoft.
And, you know, cut and paste is the same way. I think they knew cut and paste should have been in there from day one, but if they're not happy with how it's working, they're not going to ship it. You know, they're going to go, yeah, no, it's not right. You know, and we're not going to do it and put it in there till it's right.
Absolutely. Whenever anyone brings up this topic, copy and paste comes up. And I think that copy and paste is such a great example, but there's an example that a lot of people don't use, which is multimedia messaging. When the iPhone 1 or the iPhone came out, it didn't have a way to send pictures via text message. There was no way to do it. And almost every other phone, feature phones or dumb phones, as Marco likes to call them, they all had this feature. It was almost insane that the iPhone didn't have a way to send pictures. And it's just because Apple, you know, wasn't quite sure exactly how they wanted to do it yet.
Right. And then they throw iMessage at us, which I'm like totally ramped up about. I'm sure the cell companies are irritated, but I don't know if I mentioned it before, but I'll mention it now. I think that's going to be one of the sleeper features for a lot of people.
Yeah. You don't even know that it's happening because it's built into the messages application. There's not a separate app for it. You just type in the person's name and it auto detects.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the ones that's going to get people to get their friends to buy iPhones.
Yeah. I mean, there's not enough reasons
that's
already.
The weird subversive thing about that is, you know, you're going to have people who don't really get the feature, they don't understand it, but they'll have a new phone, they'll have the new OS, and then they'll suddenly realize that they can drop their SMS plan because, you know, 80% of their friends are already on iPhones, and then those people are going to be hounding the other 20%. You got to get an iPhone so we can do the iMessage thing, get off this SMS stuff, and, you know, it's going to be very bizarre.
The thing is, SMS as itself is a complete racket because SMSs travel over the data network. I mean, they're just small packets of data, and if you have unlimited data, you should automatically have unlimited text because it's the same thing.
You would think.
And phone companies just want to make more money, and Apple said, no, not anymore.
Yeah, and it's advanced enough. Again, this is one of those, I think, it's those deliberate things. And it may even tie into what you're talking about of, you know, Apple really wanting to do MMS in a certain way. And eventually they had to kind of put something in there because I think they were getting enough complaints. But I think they probably always had in their mind this concept of iMessage and a better way of doing it. And they just needed to get to the point where they had enough clout to be able to pull it off. Yeah, and I think they're at that point now. And it's like, you know, hey, mobile companies, if you want to drop the iPhone, that's fine, but we're doing this. And they're looking at them going, well, we really like all the extra revenue and customers the iPhone's bringing us now. So I think we'll let you slide on this one.
Yeah, they don't really have a choice. The one thing that does confuse me about iMessage, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, Adam, but the fact that iMessage, FaceTime, iChat are all these separate islands of what is to me the same thing,
yep. Right?
Which is messaging. And if they were going to introduce iMessage, I don't know why they didn't at that point unify. I feel like what are we waiting for on that?
I'm totally with you there. I don't know what Apple is doing in the messaging arena. I think we're getting bits and pieces, but it's like classic Apple, right? It's just like they're experimenting. They're playing around with these different things, and at some point I think there's going to be a bringing them all together. I hope it happens sooner than later, because it is getting ridiculous. It's like I have FaceTime and iChat on my Mac. Am I going to have now, are they going to do iMessage for the Mac too? And now I'm going to have iMessage, FaceTime, and iChat.
Do you ever find yourself using FaceTime?
I personally don't, but No. I talked about this when it first came out and said, I really think it's an edge feature.
Yeah.
It meets a need for a certain type of person. But you talk to people in general, and I mean, we've been talking about video calling, video messaging, whatever you want to call it, for, you know, 20 plus years. It's been the future. It's in every sci-fi movie. But when you ask people really if they want it or if they would use it for every conversation, the answer is always, for me, no. Not right. Every conversation. It's a personal form of communication. And I think for that and maybe for things like accessibility, you know, for that type of calling, yes, it's an awesome technology right. to have. But I think if you ask the average person, if they need to communicate, do they want to do voice and more or video calling? And more, the answer is no. I mean, more often people are turning to text,
right?
Email
right.
And more instant messaging, which is why I think iMessage again is going to be this huge sleeper feature, because it's going to bring a lot of functionality to a lot of people with iOS devices, and it expands on the concept of text, especially for, non-3G, 4G devices. You know, now you can get it on Wi-Fi on your iPad and your iPod Touch. It's going to be huge for parents. So, you know, no, I mean, FaceTime is great, and I'm glad that we have it, and I'm glad video messaging is there and we're able to do it. But, I you know, I maybe use it for less than 1% of my calls.
Right. I use it for far less than 1% of my calls. And the thing is, I think I take a more cynical look at it. I'm glad that we have it. However, I think that it's more of a sales thing than it is a useful feature. I think it sells phones, right? But I don't think that when people get the phones, they're suddenly FaceTiming all the time.
No, but Apple has a lot. You know, you can point out a lot of technologies like that. It's the technology that I say that give good demo, right? It's photo booth.
The Faces feature in iPhoto. I don't think people are using that.
You know, it's photo booth. It's iMovie right. on the iPhone, right? Right. iMovie on the iPhone is great demo.
Oh, it's fun. It's fun to play with.
Yeah, but are you actually going to use it a lot? No. I've edited a couple videos on vacation. It's kind of fun to do, you know, be on vacation, be able to shoot and edit a video, you know, relatively quickly and then show it to somebody. It's impressive, but you're not going to spend day in and day out doing that. You're going to go over to your Mac and you're going to use iMovie or Final Cut or on the iPad.
Well, not Final Cut anymore.
I don't know if we want to get into that debate. I'm going to get some video people on both sides, I think, and do a whole episode on that, because
that's good. I'd be really interested to hear that, because I'm not a video editor, but I've just been blown away by the number of one-star reviews and the backlash.
I think that my theory is that's a vocal minority who is ingrained and entrenched in a certain workflow.
It's the same thing when Facebook changes the news feed. It's just pure neophobia. It's being afraid of new things.
Right.
And yes, sure, there are probably a ton of features missing, but that's okay. The old product didn't stop working.
Well, and it's a transition too.
Right.
And absolutely. So those folks are going to have to, I think part of the backlash is they've been waiting so long for Apple to do something.
Sure.
And then Apple does something radical and removes a lot of features and functionality. And yes, I think for those people who really rely on a certain workflow, this is hugely disruptive. And yes, I think they're right to be probably upset, but they have to look at a bigger vision. And Apple is a disruptive company. I mean, just look at anything in their history. This is what they do, right? So it shouldn't be shocking or surprising. It's frustrating if you're in that world and that's your life and your livelihood. Yes, it's frustrating when someone comes in and disrupts that. And it's going to take, 5 years for that transition to happen. In the meantime, though, I think they have to remember it's like the current software will still work and you can still use that. You just can't jump over to the latest and greatest because Apple's rebuilding something from the ground up. And we saw it with iMovie. I mean, how much backlash was there when Apple did the iMovie thing? And there were tons of people like, I'm not moving. I'm using iMovie 6 forever or iMovie HD or whatever it was. But, if you kind of give in and start to see the vision and accept it, I tried to do that with iMovie and I love the new iMovie. I think it's much faster, much easier to edit with, I like the new workflow methodology a lot better. But, it took me a couple years to get there.
So, yeah.
And it is going to take a couple years. So I think the problem is it's made it a not useful production tool for a certain segment of users. And they're going to have to deal with that while Apple kind of rebuilds and rethinks the technology. So,
absolutely.
Well, cool. I want to move into kind of what you're up to and talk a little bit about how do you transition? So I knew you from podcasting. You started some podcast networks, kind of built up a little podcasting thing, got involved in school, and now you're developing apps. We're going to get to the app that you guys put together, which is really cool, by the way. But how does that happen? How did you transition from sort of podcasting to coding or building apps?
Sure. Well, I think podcasting was all I really enjoyed doing the show. I did a show called Escape Radio every week, and it was just I was 13 at the time. My voice was Mickey Mouse a level of highness. Mm-hmm. But the joy for me wasn't the talking into microphones. It was connecting with people and making things.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I love developing ideas, and I love getting the emails from Germany, people saying, oh, I love the show. You taught me about this new thing. And so when I was in line on day one for the original iPhone, I skipped the 3G, went right to the 3GS, and then I got an iPhone 4 on day one after working at Apple Retail for 26 hours straight. But... So I've been, I think I've installed hundreds and hundreds of applications. I've spent way too much money on iPhone applications since then.
I think we all have.
Yeah. Oh, my God. There's an app that actually tracks the amount of money that you've spent on iPhone apps. Never install that. That's a depressing idea.
You don't want to know out of sight, out of mind. It's your best strategy.
So in 2009, I had out of nowhere, I had an idea for an iPhone app. I looked around in the store, and it didn't exist. And I had been, programming since forever. I don't know. I've been programming for a while, but mostly doing, web programming, a little bit of Ruby and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't really ever gotten into Objective-C. So I decided to talk to my friend, who's also a programmer. We both knew Java, and we figured we could learn Objective-C fairly easily. And we watched the Stanford class, CS193P. I could not recommend it more. It's on iTunes U. It's free to watch.
Yeah.
You can watch every single lecture. They're an hour and a half. We watched, I think, the inaugural, I want to call it a season, but it's actually a semester.
Right.
The first semester with Evan Dahl, who now works, he's the co-founder of Flipboard.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
He taught the class along with some other people. And we just started learning it, and we built this application. Now, that application didn't end up working out for some pretty complicated reasons. I'm not sure we want to go into it, but right. We have written a blog post detailing it, blog.lickability.net, if you are interested.
What was that app, and what did it do?
Yeah, that's it was called Broadway, and mm-hmm. I'm a theater nerd. I've did theater in high school. I've done theater since I was five.
Awesome.
And so what it did was it allowed you to see all the shows on Broadway, buy tickets online or by phone, and it gave you the listings and the theaters, directions to those theaters. It was really a really useful thing, and no other app like it existed at the time. There wasn't any app on the App Store for Broadway listings at all. So we were really early on that. And to sum it up, the reason why it didn't work out is we didn't have a partner for that data. So we were using a publicly available data feed. And when we went to that company to partner with them, they sort of gave us the runaround and then ended up stealing a lot of our interface ideas. So it was a huge learning experience. And I could have – and Brian and I could have just given up then, right? We could have just said, okay, well, that's iPhone application. We just wasted a summer on this. But that's not what we did.
Huh? Sorry.
Oh, no problem.
No, if you don't mind me pausing you right there, I want to ask you about this because this does come up in a lot of the conversations that I have. Yeah. Because as I mentioned at the top of the show, a lot of this is about ideas. A lot of people have ideas. You had a great idea and, you know, you pulled up your bootstraps and dug in, you know, to your elbows and figured out how to make it happen. And you brought up this idea of community, and I get the question from a lot of people of, I have this great idea, I don't know how to execute it, I need people to help me, yeah. or I need outside resources, but I'm afraid to share it with anybody,
yeah.
because I'm afraid it's going to get stolen. So you having this experience where, you know, you went out to find a partner, and that kind of happens to you, and we talked about it, you know, Apple doing this to some developers sure. to a certain degree. What's your advice to someone having gone through that? You know, what's your advice to someone? Do you not do that, or it sounds like it turned out to be more of a positive experience because you learned and grew from it.
We learned a great deal from that. And I think that there are just a certain class of applications that you can't do on your own. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't do them.
Right.
Right. What you need to do is you probably should consult a lawyer. Mm-hmm. You might want to, you know, write up a contract with a non-compete or some kind of clause before you start showing or really before you start building that application, before you start showing it to people. Because the mistake that I think that we made was we built the whole application, right? We built all the way up to version one without sort of letting anyone know about it mm-hmm. because we were sort of afraid of that. And then once we got it to 1.0, we realized, well, we could just release this, but this public data feed might go away and we might have a lot of really unhappy customers.
Right.
So we should probably, you know, set up a relationship, and we didn't do an NDA. We didn't do any kind of contracts. I mean, we're young. We were sure. young. So I think that you can build an application with publicly available data, and if that data is not, you know, specifically licensed or going to stay around, then you should really have a contract for that.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it should stop somebody, though, too? I mean, like, if you had it to do over, would you have not reached out to that company? Or it sounds like you just would have approached it differently.
I think we approached it the wrong way. I think that we could have avoided that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that it wasn't the way that they went about it wasn't good for them. I think that our application is much better than the one that they ended up releasing.
Sure.
And I'm not just saying that. I mean, there's some specific functional things that I can point to. So it's a tough question, but I think you really should, if you're going to build something that you can't do completely by yourself, maybe not do it as your first thing out of the gate. Maybe build something, you know, that you have complete control of first.
Right.
Just prove to yourself that you can do it, and also build some credibility so that when you do go to somebody to partner with them, you can say, look, I've been through this before. I've had this app. I put it out. It's been featured by Apple. It's you know, a really great app, and I want to do this with you, and then you're in a much better position to negotiate.
Right. And I think there's another thing, though, too, and this came up a little bit with Michael, and you mentioned community. I think the developer community, sort of the inside community, might be a little bit different, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my impression is that, you know, here we're talking about an outside company that was providing data, but they're not really part of that Mac, iOS, developer, Apple community. And I think there's far less of this sort of stealing of ideas, or, you know, like, I think you're a little bit safer in this kind of confined app environment. And I'm not saying 100%, I'm not saying you shouldn't take steps to protect your stuff, like you were mentioning, you know, potentially having contracts or stuff like that, or being selective about who you share your information with. Yeah. But I think you're at less of a risk, or that's my general impression.
I have to agree with you wholeheartedly. Through the process of developing our second application, we got feedback from a lot of the people, and we are continuing to get feedback from a lot of the people in the Mac and iOS developer community, the design community, that we have admired over many years. And we've had no problems, and everyone has been extremely gracious with their time and their feedback. And Michael said this in your interview with him, but really, just email people. I mean, email me, email people, send them your ideas and screenshots. Don't be afraid of that, because everybody's busy. We've all got work to do. We're not going to steal your idea. That's not good for us. People will call it out on Twitter. It'll be a huge problem. And there's just no incentive. I mean, most iOS developers are great people. And if you need feedback on something, you can, I think, trust the community a lot more than you can trust people who aren't in the community.
Yeah. What's your impression on face-to-face versus virtual? I know you mentioned email. There's a lot of great online communities. My general thought is that you should be doing both. But that there is a lot of value in finding a group. I'm a big fan of meetup.com, and I'm constantly pointing people to that if there's not already some kind of user group in your area. But just actually reaching out to a local community, because I think at a certain point, you're going to want to sit down over a computer or over some code with somebody, and just, you know, show each other stuff or exchange ideas in that way. There's just this kind of connection, I think, that happens that you can't get from exchanging emails. I'm not saying that, or, you know, forum posts, but I'm not saying that that isn't valuable, but I think there's a whole different kind of value that comes out of, you know, meeting someone in person.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I'm kind of ashamed because I wasn't able to go to WWDC this year. I'm really hoping to be there next year. Mm-hmm. And I haven't been to any...
You mean you weren't up at 6 in the morning and didn't get in the first 5 minutes?
Exactly. oh, man.
I don't know how... What's wrong with you?
They're going to need to do something about that. But if you have the opportunity to go to any of the events that Michael talked about, the NS Coders, the smaller conferences, or meetup.com or anything like that, just go. A lot of nerds are introverted people.
Right.
A lot of programmers are kind of introverted. But that doesn't mean that they're not also social. Right. And if you push yourself a little bit, because I mean, for me, even it's a push to go meet a whole bunch of people that I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, not only the stuff that we were talking about earlier about, you know, potential intellectual property issues, but also just this is a lot of information for me to process. This is a lot of, you know, social events are hard for some people. And so, but if you push yourself, it's a lot of the same kind of people as you. And so you'll get that sense of camaraderie almost instantly, and you'll be able to dive into some code or just talk about ideas or talk about what Apple's doing and have a conversation sort of like this one.
Right.
And
Yeah. The other thing in getting into this that I'm discovering is that there's a lot of people that are non-technical that are real hesitant to reach out to a group, to go into a developer community and stuff like that, but who have great concepts and ideas and just need help executing those. And I think about the group that I go to here in San Diego. A friend of mine started the San Diego iOS users group. And part of his core mission when establishing that was making sure to include not just coders and developers, but also idea people. Designers are a huge aspect. So we've had some sessions just about how to build graphics elements and how to do that sort of thing. And also marketing, just you know, marketing and business development people are also, we're trying to pull in so that we can, it's really about the networking of that, of those people and folks and getting them together to create things. I think that's really important because, you know, as you mentioned, you dove in and got into it and created something because you enjoy doing that. Some people have a hard time doing that on their own and really right. do need to reach out to others to make that happen. But there's a lot of people out there like you. And if we can get more of these people connected, I guess this is what I'm excited about. And I'm excited about what Apple's doing is that if we can get more of these people together, we get more great stuff like the products that you're building.
Well, I couldn't do it on my own either. There's no way that I could have built the application, the QuoteBook application that we built in the amount of time without my incredible team members, right? Brian Capps is a developer and a brilliant designer. And my other friend, Andrew Harrison, he likes to go by Twig. He is a developer and he also helps us out with product decisions and testing and customer support. And we all try to know as much of what each other does as possible. And I think that keeps the application fresh and it keeps our workflow moving along. And we also, going back to the meeting up thing, we try to meet up as much as we can. Sort of, we're all spread out in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, but we have sort of central locations that we mm-hmm. that we go to. And we're doing a big meetup next week, actually. We're calling it the Pad at Pad, where we're going to work on some concepts for the iPad app. So I think that you're absolutely right. It doesn't just take a programmer to make a great application. There are some programmers that by themselves can make great applications, sure. But they also have to have a lot of other skill sets. And sometimes the best way to do that is by bringing in people with those specific skill sets. So yeah. Getting developers to meet designers and marketers and just product people, product managers, people who are good at steering developers in the right way, is really productive and makes for better apps, more stable applications, and more beautiful applications. And that's something that we really try to strive for.
Right. Okay. I want to get to the app. One quick question before that. You talked about the great iTunes U sessions from Stanford in terms of yes. learning coding. I get a lot of people that go, okay, I want to get into coding. I've done some things, you know, HTML, Java, JavaScript. I've played around, or I have no experience at all. But I have this idea and I think I want to try and, you know, execute it myself. I'm a more technical person. How do I get started? I get this question asked all the time.
So do I.
And so what do you tell those people?
What I say is that there are so many good resources and a lot of them are completely free on the internet. So don't really spend money until you have to. Like I bought a couple of the books and most of them I've been not that impressed with. I mean, there are some exceptions. Craig Hockenberry's book, The iPhone App Dev Manual, mm-hmm. wonderful book. I would recommend everyone who wants to do this to buy it. It walks you through the entire process. It's not a programming book in that it walks you through from idea all the way through release and marketing. And it should be on everyone's iBookshelf or whatever. But the Stanford CS193P classes on iTunes U, just go there. Just download the first one. Watch it. If that's above your level, right? If you're, because there are some prerequisites for that class if you're taking it at Stanford. You have to have taken a class in either C or Java. You have to know programming, right? If that's too much for you, then you're probably going to want to start at a learning programming level.
Right.
It's Objective-C is a language that a lot of programmers have said is really pretty difficult to learn as your first programming language, right? There are languages that are better suited for that. And I know that it might feel like, well, but I just want to build this app.
Right.
So why would I go learn another language? But if you're struggling with the Stanford classes, that would really probably be the best way to go, is to pick up maybe Python or Java first.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, just a cursory understanding so that you get the concepts and then move into something more difficult like Objective-C. Now, that being said, there are plenty of people that I know that Objective-C is their first programming language. You can do it. Other than that, as soon as you can, I would recommend joining the Apple Developer Program. And you said you're a member of this. What you do is you go to developer.apple.com, and it's $99 a year. And that may seem like a lot, but you get a lot out of that. You get not only access to all the Apple documentation, which is freely available, but you also get access to the beta documentation and the beta builds of iOS.
Right.
So you've got iOS 5 so that you can test with that. not only on your device, but also in the iPhone simulator, which is a tool that runs on the desktop. So you can see a little iPhone screen, play around with it. You also get Xcode, which by itself would be $5 on the Mac App Store. You don't have to buy that if you're a developer. You also get access to all of these videos that we were talking about earlier. There's 109 of them this year. And these are videos by Apple engineers that took place at WWDC, and they are so good. I sometimes have a hard time getting even people on the team to watch them because mm-hmm. they're each 50 minutes long,
right.
or longer, and they're sometimes a bit tedious because you're not looking at a person, you're just looking at slides. But the people who are giving the presentations are Apple engineers, and they're brilliant, and they spend so much time on these videos. I mean, these are not just like threw a PowerPoint together. These are keynote presentations that they spent weeks on, it seems like, because they're funny, they're well laid out. That's another really, really good resource for picking up some other stuff. And then if you need to buy one book, the book that I would recommend is the one by Aaron Hillglass.
Yep.
I don't remember the name. There's the Mac one is called Cocoa Programming for Mac OS X. It's in its third edition, I believe. And there's an iPhone one as well. If you can't learn from videos or books, I haven't done this personally, but everyone who I've talked to has done this, has loved it. The Big Nerd Ranch.
Big Nerd Ranch, yeah.
Big Nerd Ranch is a in-person, very intense training session. I think it takes place over a couple of days, maybe a week.
I think it's about a week, yeah.
A week long.
Boot
and
camp.
You go there. I'm not sure where it's located, but they will whip you into shape. They'll teach you this stuff, and yeah. you will know it.
Montana or something like that. I don't know, but it's my dream to go to that.
yeah.
It's not cheap. Let's just put it that way, but it's like all inclusive and you are just thrown into code.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a blast.
So you said you're looking at learning some of this stuff. What tools have you been using? I'm just curious.
Same ones.
Yeah.
I give everybody exactly the same recommendation. The Aaron Hillglass book, the online resources from Apple, getting in the developer program. Yeah, absolutely. All of those things. The Stanford iTunes U classes.
I am glad you're on message, Adam.
Yeah, and we did not talk about this stuff beforehand, but
no.
I think you glob onto all the same resources. You know, some of the developer communities I'm not as familiar with as you are. You know, Michael brought up some of those, and
that's a great point. If you have questions, there is one place to go, and that's stackoverflow.com. Started by Jeff Atwood and forgetting his name, Joel Spolsky from Joel on Software. It is a highly, highly optimized question and answer site for programmers. You can ask anything there. There's no question that's too stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You can ask any question, and the system will provide you, if it thinks that question's been asked before, it'll provide you it'll automatically search. So
right.
If you don't feel like you have to go need to search first, you can actually just start typing a question. It'll provide you the answers automatically.
I love that
extensively.
Me too. I use it for web programming. I mean, that's the other great thing about it is it's not just Cocoa, and it's like any language. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Great resource. All right. Well, let's talk about the app. So you had this idea. You found a couple partners. You found some people to work with. So how did you meet up and tell everybody, you know, the concept of the app and what the app does?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, I want to make sure that people know that I'm not taking any credit for the concept whatsoever.
Okay.
The concept was not mine. It was actually a concept of a guy named Alex Payne. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Alex. But
yeah,
Alex...
I think so.
Yeah, Alex is a brilliant, brilliant developer and a brilliant writer on the web. He writes at al3x.net, the number 3. And he was one of the first developers at Twitter. He developed some of or all, I'm not sure. He worked on the Twitter API. He was the key guy on that.
I think that's where I might know him from.
Yeah, he's brilliant. And he, on his weblog about 2 years ago, he just threw out an iPhone app idea called Quotidian, which was essentially the idea that the germ of the idea that became Quotebook. And we sent him an email just to let him know, like, he posted it as sort of an open idea, like, I don't have time to build this, sort of, you know, in that community spirit, just anyone who wants to take this on.
Right.
And I thought it was a great idea from the moment I read it. And I sort of filed it away in my brain. We got through Broadway. We took a little bit of a break after that to start up school. And then we started in October of last year working on this application. And it started off as a side project, right? We, Andrew and myself, primarily in the very beginning in October, were roommates at college. And so after we got done classes and goofing off, we would sit in front of my computer and just sort of play around Interface Builder and see if it would even be a workable idea. And I think that's a good thing to do. Don't commit to building your application fully. Just start working on it, see if it works, right? And at the point that we realized that this was a viable and cool idea, we brought Brian in on it and said, like, hey, we're gonna do this. And we came up with what we thought was going to be the key features of 1.0. And Michael, in your interview, talks about you need to ship your 1.0. So don't put every feature ever in there.
Right.
I mean, write down every feature you think of, but don't put them all under the 1.0 headline, right? We use GitHub to manage our source control management, and there's a they have an issue tracker in there, and we have milestones for each of our releases. So we put all the 1.0 issues under the 1.0 milestone, and we just started or all of the 1.0 features under the 1.0 milestone, we just started working on those. So we came up with a design that we liked before we threw out the sort of prototype that we were working on and came up with a design that we thought would work, started working on implementing that design. Spent a good deal of time on it. And then we found out through some user testing, usability testing, we just do hallway usability testing, just friends in the cafeteria giving the phone over to people who have an iPhone and say, hey, try and use this. And then really pay attention to what they do. And we found out that it wasn't really working. The design that we had wasn't really working. And so we went back to the drawing board. Actually, literally, I had a huge whiteboard in my dorm room, and I would just sketch out new ideas for the design. Mm-hmm. So we came up with the design that we're using today, and we rebuilt the application. Didn't throw it away. We just sort of moved some things around to get it to work. And then started using that, and people were starting to get it. They were starting to jive on the user interface. So we kept working on it. And then the last 10% is the hardest to do, all the polish. I think there's a WWDC session from this year called Polishing Your App. I hope that's not under NDA. And so taking it and doing the last 10% to get it to where, the icon design is perfect, all of the transitions are perfect, all the rotation is perfect. That stuff took us took what felt like the longest of the whole project.
Mm-hmm. So just so in case nobody caught that, what is the app? What does it do?
Oh yeah, totally forgot to mention that. Quotebook is an application that is we call it a notebook for your quotes. So we looked around the app store and we saw that there's all these quote applications. There's tons of apps in the reference category for quotes, right? Famous quotations. But they all share one thing in common, which is that they come with tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of quotes built in. And we decided, and a lot of them make it very difficult or impossible to add your own as you sort of come across things in literature or movies or just chats with your friends. We decided, and Alex's idea supported the fact that this was the wrong way to go for us and the kinds of users that we wanted to target. So we decided that Quotebook is an application that starts as a completely blank slate. It's an app that doesn't have anything in it, but it allows you to really quickly capture important bits of language, quotes that matter to you, we say. So you hit the plus button and you type in a quotation, and it allows you to type in the author and source, give it a rating of 1 to 5 stars and some tags so you can organize it. And then it also makes it really easy to share. So it allows you to post those quotes they're really nicely formatted to Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and also send them out via SMS and email. And the sharing is a really a big part of Quotebook, because we saw that a lot of people were posting quotes to their Facebook statuses or sending them out as tweets. And it's much easier to do it if you're doing it from inside of Quotebook, because we put the curly quotes around it automatically. We give you the nice end dash with the author, and people have found it really useful. Just some examples of what people are using it for. There was a father who emailed me a couple of weeks ago and said that he's using it to keep track of his kid's first words, which is a brilliant use, because we keep track of the date and you can tag it, and then you can go back and share those things with your family and friends.
Cool. Very cool. I you know, you sent it to me and I didn't even realize that you were working on this project. And just looking at it, immediately I thought of a use case for myself because I'm constantly doing research for the show and I always want to make sure that whatever sources I'm pulling from, I'm able to go back and credit where that's from. And it's so often that I might be on another show or a podcast and I'm trying to remember something somebody had said in an article. And you can never recall it, right?
Yeah,
so if
exactly.
I had a nice tool that I could just quickly search or pull up something, then I can give credit where credit's due, right?
Yeah, totally. That's the exact kind of things that we're thinking about it for, especially for writers. If you're writing a paper for college or if you're writing a speech and you want to just throw in a quick aphorism or something that somebody said, you can have all that information in your pocket.
Right, right. So I'm curious now. Because you start with an idea, right?
Right.
And you go, what is the determination? And I think I get this question a lot, and maybe you do too. Now you have choices in the Apple world. It used to be we just had Macs, so you had to write a Mac app. But now more and more, I think it's being split kind of three ways. It sounds like you started with iPhone, and mm-hmm. now you're thinking about iPad and probably potentially about OS X. But how do you know where to start? Like, where do you just kind of pick, oh, I like the iPhone the best, or I think this fits that, or how did you determine that you were going to start with iOS and move on from there?
That's a great question. I think it came down to a number of factors. The number one factor is that we had experience on iOS. So people may know that iOS and macOS 10 use the same programming language, but they use a very different framework for user interface. So it is actually a lot of learning if you're going to switch from iOS to macOS 10. So we didn't want to put that learning up front. We figured that if the application gained traction, then we might want to learn that at that point. Also, iOS has a huge built-in... I mean, when we started this, the Mac App Store didn't exist.
Right.
So it has a huge built-in marketplace. We don't have to worry about credit card processing. We don't have to worry about any of that stuff. And there are people who are just looking for apps to buy. So at that point, it felt like a much easier road to profit. Mm-hmm. Which is something that we were looking at. Another factor is just thinking about, you know, in user experience design, there's this idea of personas. So coming up with a couple of imaginary users that might use your application, and then think about the devices and computers that they might have. And I think for most of the people that use QuoteBook, they might have a desktop computer, but I think primarily, they want to be able to use it on the go. So the iPhone app makes the most sense. And yeah, sure, they might have an iPad, but I think that when they're capturing quotes, they're not carrying around their iPad with them.
Right.
Right. So I think it definitely makes sense that we went with iPhone and iPod Touch first. And then, of course, expanding out to the iPad is a lot easier than jumping over the iPad to go to macOS 10. So that's probably the direction that we're going to go.
Right. That's a great point. Thinking about... how your concept or your idea fits into how people actually function, you know, in the real world.
It's a crazy idea, I know.
But, you know, it's funny we say that. It's a crazy idea, and we say that, you know, like, duh. But really, there's tons of examples of companies doing exactly the opposite of that. Just like...
I know.
You know,
I know.
Luckily, Apple isn't one of those very often. I mean, occasionally that you scratch your head, but they really do focus on, it's this idea of focusing on use first rather than kind of the technology. I mean, the technology's there. You know, the technology is going to be a part of it just by the sheer fact of what you're building, right? But it's sort of like the experience is going to make or break the technology, the interaction somebody has with it. And so I think you're absolutely right with a thing like quotes or, you know, I'm trying to think of some other examples. I had some just a second ago, but something like quotes is you're going to get something, you're going to hear about something right there, and you're going to want to capture that, right?
Yes.
Instantly. Yep. And if you don't have a device to do that with, you know, if your Mac's back at home, well, it's going to go into the ether. But you know, if you can pull your iPhone out of your pocket and put it in there, then that makes sense.
I have a great example of this. I was watching an episode of Mad Men last night. I'm a little bit behind on that show, but there was a quote that one of the characters had said, "The faintest ink is better than the best memory." And I thought that was so beautiful. and I wanted to write it down, which is sort of cyclical in its own way. So I just pulled out my phone, wrote it down. I didn't have to take the video out of full screen, go to a website, type it in. The design of the application supported the use case that I wanted, which is exactly what we're trying to do.
Right. So really, yeah, really thinking about, you know, what platform, what technology is going to make sense for how your potential customer is going to need to use the product, right?
Right. Yep.
Very, very cool. Well, I think we're about an hour or so, so I'll probably wrap things up. If people want to get more information about your application, want to find out about the company, find out what's going on with you, maybe get in contact with you about development, what have you, what is the best way for somebody to do all that?
Well, that is a lot of different avenues. But let me just say, if you want to download QuoteBook, you can just search for QuoteBook on the App Store, one word. We're the one with the black icon with the curly quotes, because there are a lot of apps that have similar names. Or you can go to QuoteBookApp.com, watch a screencast of it, read our release notes, our FAQs, see all the features and press and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do that, twitter.com/MB. I was very, very early on Twitter, so I've got a 2-character username.
That's pretty awesome.
our company, we called it Lickability, sort of after a Steve Jobs quote from 2001 where he talked about the Aqua interface being extremely lickable.
Yeah.
It's lickability.net. And my personal website is matthewbischoff.com. That has links to everything else that I do.
Very, very cool. Well, Matthew, it's great to be able to reconnect with you. I know it's been a long time, but it sounds like you've been up to some really, really cool stuff. I'm going to have to follow what you're up to a little bit more closely now, I think.
It's been a blast, Adam.
I appreciate you coming on and talking with the MacCast. So that's Matthew Bischoff from Lickability. The app is called QuoteBook. I want to thank him for coming on and chatting with us. I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly enjoy having these conversations with the developers. Before I leave you today, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors, Gazelle. You know what? If you need to get rid of an old piece of electronics gear and you don't want to deal with the hassle of auction sites or listing classifieds, try Gazelle at gazelle.com. You can do a quick search and get a quick upfront quote cash for your used electronics, gazelle.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, you can check out their software as well as get free demos over at circusponies.com. Smile, be sure to check out Text Expander Touch, along with PDF Pen and Disk Label, all great applications. They have more information, details, as well as trials over at smilesoftware.com. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac, check out their software over at Phoronix.com. And Stitcher Smart Radio, you can go to Stitcher.com/MacCast now. Get details, and when you download the app, be sure to use the code MacCast when you register to be entered in the drawing for an iPad 2. So thank you to all of those sponsors for their continued support of the show. Big thank you to you. You know, if you're liking these interviews with developers, I'm having a really great time doing them, and you'd like to hear more, let me know about that. Also, if you have comments, questions about anything you've heard on any episode of the MacCast, or you have a topic maybe you'd like me to cover in the future, question, you can send your thoughts, your emails. Really welcome audio comments. If you want to record them on the built-in recorder on your iPod Touch or iPhone, it works great. Just take that file, email it to me. You can even do it directly from the app. You can send all that stuff to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline. I have a voicemail. It's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Or if you prefer to use Skype, you can use the Skype name TheMacCast and leave a voicemail there. Look forward to hearing all your comments and feedback. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast.com website. And also, while you're there, be sure to check out the forum. That's MacCast.com and forum.MacCast.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. And I look forward to seeing you online. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.